This show is brought to you by Safety FM.
Hi listeners, this is Brent Sutton. Welcome to the 70th episode of the Practice of Learning Teams podcast show. On today's show, I'm joined by James McPherson, who wears many hats as an operational risk professional, podcaster, YouTuber, coach, husband, and proud dad. I like the style that James brings to the new view of safety, so I thought it was a great opportunity to connect with him and talk about the mad, mad world of James McPherson. So please sit back and enjoy this episode of the pod. I thought it was just a really good opportunity to catch up and say hello and see how the mad world of safety differently, new view, safety two, whatever we want to call it, how's it all going and what you've been finding, and treat it like a bit of a year on reflection.
Well, a year on reflection, Jesus, that's it's been a mad year for us at Rebranding Safety, if I'm honest. So when I started the podcast, coming up to 3 years ago now, I kind of thought I had the monopoly on this new view stuff, if I'm honest, Brent. Like, I'd never heard of Sidney Decker or Todd Conklin or any, I didn't even know who they were, like four or five years ago, didn't even know who they were. And I thought, God, I've got such a better way of thinking about safety and risk management. I should write a book about this, or I should write blogs or something. I started writing a blog and I realized I can't spell or anything. So I was like, oh, maybe I should do a podcast. Started a podcast, and then we did it for coming up to 3 years now. And I stumbled across this kind of safety differently stuff and was like, all right, maybe I should read these books and have a look. And then we kind of got deep into that safety one versus safety two, new view versus old view argument. And I kind of was like, I don't really know what it's much. So it must have been about a year ago that we did the safety one, safety two mini series, mm-hmm. where we started off with Todd, who had a chat with Todd. But then after Todd, really, we had Todd and Dom. So two kind of very prominent academic voices in so-called new view and so-called old view. and then after that, we pretty much spoke to practitioners. And then from them, man, I've just kind of read books, interviewed these people, and then tried to experiment it with my own time. But Rebranding Safety has just gone mad. So in England, I think we're still playing around with these things, and I think we're still struggling with it, which I suppose the rest of the world is as well. But ultimately, I think we're trying to do something with New View, in my opinion, particularly in England. We're trying to do something which goes against the grain of how we run business and how we manage businesses in our kind of the way that we've run businesses for so long. Have ultimately we've had in blame, we've had people being the problem, we've had segregation, we've had, you know, all of this stuff, silos drummed into us for years and years and years. Particularly in England, I think there's always somebody else's fault. It's always somebody else. You know, we don't take any accountability for our own actions or anything like that. So when we're trying to battle with this new view stuff, mate, it's a challenge in England. It really is. To the point where, interestingly, it's a funny little story. The other day, I've got a about 14-month-old baby girl, and my neighbours, really lovely neighbors, come and knocked on the door a couple of weeks back, right? And he said, oh, we've got loads of old, like, kids books from when our little boy was really young, wondering if you wanted them for when Maggie grows up. And I said, oh yeah, that's really lovely. So we took these books in, right? I was going through them and had the classic story of Noah's Ark, mm-hmm. like a little kid's version of Noah's Ark, right? Now, I understand this is a religious story, so any of your listeners, or if we use the audio, any of the kind of religious listeners of my podcast as well, hear this. nothing against religion. You do you, man. You know, whatever helps you, you do that. But I read through this book, and well, actually, my wife had read a couple of pages. She gave it to me. She was like, "Oh, James, do you want to have a think about this book?" And it was blame ingrained throughout it, mm-hmm. like this whole notion of like the world had screwed up and God had punished us. And I was just like, "Wow, we're indoctrinating my 14-month-old daughter, before she's even old enough to understand that." Ultimately, there's more to a story as to why people kind of behave how they behave or make decisions that they make. And ultimately, that put in context for me the challenges that I've been having over the last year at Rebranding Safety, trying to talk about all this stuff. It was fascinating.
And look, there's no doubt there's a challenge, because I think that the notion is that a lot of people are trying to simplify what all this is, and I think that's where we're going wrong. And I remember when I first met up with Todd, I think one of the things that resonated with me so clearly was what he talked about, was that it's not about simplification, it's about transparency, it's about making things more visible.
Yeah.
And how we make something visible and how we simplify it is very, very different. And I think our whole focus is simply on that. How do you make something transparent?
It's interesting, because ultimately I do think we have the challenge here of this whole issue around simplification. We as a profession ultimately have an interesting challenge, because we have to simplify the message to communicate it to our audience. Inevitably, like the managers that we're trying to communicate this stuff to, operational leaders, you know, CEOs, they've got so much stuff they're dealing with. And we're going to turn up and talk about behavioral science, human factors, resilience engineering, whatever you want to call it, or all of the above. And you're going to start talking about all of this stuff, which essentially is kind of sociology, mm-hmm. psychology, stuff like that. And this guy's like, looking at it, and he's like, "Mate, I've got a degree in accountancy. Can you just tell me, you know, when is it one and when is it zero?" Mm-hmm. And we have got this massive challenge now of we need to simplify a message without oversimplifying it. And then ultimately stop the leadership from simplifying that message, because I am seeing a bit of a trend of kind of new view done, in my opinion, very oversimplified, which I'm kind of concerned, Brent. It just becomes another behavior-based safety. It becomes the next behavior-based safety that was not used how it was intended to be used, and it just becomes the next problem. So in 5 years' time, we'll have another somebody that writes Safety 3 or writes new view.
Sure, and sadly, that is what we call productization.
Yeah.
So I did a pod. I released a pod yesterday, but I wrote an article for Jeffrey Lith on the Safety Differently website last year, and I talked about the fact that why are we not implementing Safety differently? Why are we using the same traditional Safety 1 techniques and Safety Differently? And I use this language, but if we don't do Safety differently, are we drifting towards failure? So it's no different. I mean, what I've seen is a proliferation as the new view becomes more widely appreciated. You've got all these people offering certification courses, training courses, you know, all the same old things that were always done before. They haven't thought about how do we approach it differently.
Well, I think as well, like, they don't know any other. So like for such a long time, well, I say they, that's a very sweeping generalisation.
Yeah. Well, we can do that on a podcast.
Just for welcome to the world of sweeping generalisations. Yeah. I think that we are so used to productization that it's really hard to step away from that. So I've actually found, And actually, this, I got to give the guys a shout out. This actually revelation in my head came from reading the Safety of Work paper by David Provan and Drew Ray, and I think somebody else kind of co-wrote it with them, mm-hmm. but ultimately talking about safety work and the safety of work. Mm-hmm. So, e.g., how safe is the job as we do the actual job, installing a boiler, for example, and then all of the safety work we do, risk assessment, safe systems of work, blah, 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 observations, whatever you want to call them, all of that stuff. And how that kind of influences the safety of work. And I think it was really kind of, maybe not something I didn't know, but definitely the paper helped me understand it better, is this separation between impact on the reality of work, workers done, as we would call it, and this other little world of the safety work. And I think it's really interesting when they break down in that paper, they break down kind of work into categories. So you've got like social safety, the stuff mm-hmm. that we say that makes us feel safe, right? So Vision Zero would fall into that category. Lang O'Rourke's, what do they call their new view scheme? I can't remember. Next Gear at Lang O'Rourke, things like that. You're kind of sweeping statements to, we're going to keep everybody safe or go home safe, whatever. That's your social safety. It makes us feel safe. We've got like physical safety, guards, PPE, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That's easy. Demonstrated safety. So the stuff that we do to demonstrate to external shareholders and stakeholders that what we're doing, e.g. insurers, the regulator, things like that. And then admin safety, like the structures that we have that are administrative that try to influence the safety of work. So all of those are influencing the safety work, but kind of admin work provides the structure within the workplace. And it made me really reflect on it as to like, well, this is really fascinating now, because when we start to really look at what we're doing, if we approach it with this mindset, it allows us to acknowledge that the world likes their badges. They like their productization of stuff. They like their certificates. Let them have it, because we're not going to win that battle yet. We might ultimately like to address that issue later on, like the issues with ISOs, the issue that we focus so much on the badges and the certificates more than we actually focus on the impact that we have. But ultimately, we can kind of separate that and say that's demonstrated safety. There's a little bit that it does that impacts the working world, but ultimately it's demonstrated safety. It has a value to the organization because it helps keep our insurance premiums down and so on and so forth, keeps the shareholders happy, blah, blah, blah. But the rest of the stuff we do is actually about impacting real safety of work. Sure. So I think there's benefit right now to separate those two worlds, because I don't think we're going to impact that desire for productization, that desire for a certificate and a badge.
If I think to someone like Edward Deming, who did some really fascinating work, he basically talked about this whole language that you're wanting work teams to self-improve.
Yeah.
So how can you create an environment that allows the work teams to self-improve? And every work team will have a different method or approach that they use to self-improve.
Yes.
Because he's saying it's the organic nature of that is what matters, rather than following a physical process.
Yeah, I agree.
So the issue that we have, and I understand this, and particularly when I think about things like HOP and learning teams, people struggle with this thing called the organic nature of it.
Agreed.
Because they're used to having these fixed frameworks or these categorizations, things that they can see and they can touch in that space. So at the moment, I've been doing an experiment where we're looking at a zero training method of gaining a competency with learning teams.
Okay.
Which sounds quite bizarre.
No training at all? Or are these people going in at a certain level of competence?
No.
What are you trying?
So what we're doing, so we're not saying go on a course or do this or do something that's very specific. So the way that we're doing that is we've defined what would good look like. So what would the things that someone would exhibit? What would be the sum of things that a person would be able to relate to or rationalize?
Yeah.
And then we're getting people to evaluate where they're at. So what's the current state of knowledge? So we said, here's the future state. Here's your current state.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we're using an organic mechanism that allows those people to basically build their roadmap to move from current state to future state. But at the same time, as they move along that roadmap, they can look back and reflect and see how far they've come.
Yeah, okay.
So the example that we've been using is that, of course, we actually use a learning team. So we're getting a group of people together. And through that learning team, they're telling us their stories around what they see as what are their barriers, what are their obstacles, what's worked well, what hasn't worked well for them in terms of trying these things. And then from that, we identify a series of themes that come from that conversation. We then create some form activity so that person can now go out in between that and the next session and try something and reflect on that by themselves, then come back together as a group, and the group reflect on what they found.
Yeah.
And then from that, there's the next series of themes, and we keep moving down what's called this pathway. Because every person is at a different level, and every person is going to have a slightly different path. So what we've been experimenting with is this whole concept of what we call it a cohort mentoring. Our job is to basically facilitate a learning team to understand the key threads and create activities to move people along their continuum and their roadmap.
I do lots of things. So we got like Rebinding Safety, obviously, which runs, which is a podcast, a YouTube channel. And then also we offer consulting services now, which is brand new. This is actually the first podcast that we've ever actually publicly announced. That. So you've got the exclusive here, Brent.
Fantastic.
Well, we're going to start off with Rebranding Safety, but actually the company that sits behind Rebranding Safety, that owns Rebranding Safety, is called RiskFluent. So that's been there the whole time.
Okay.
So our company, our group, I suppose, is actually RiskFluent. So the consulting service is actually provided by RiskFluent. But for now, people know the brand Rebranding Safety, so we're just going to stick with that.
Sure.
And then we'll see how it evolves later on. But anyway, the point I was going to make was, what sounds really interesting is another organization that RiskFluent owns. So I built, co-founded with Colin Nottage, who runs IMG, and also podcast called the Interest Safety Podcast. Me and him co-founded mid-COVID, never met each other, which is a funny story in its own right. We launched a company called Project Militium. So that essentially is founded on the models of kind of like the mastermind communities, which are really popular here in the UK, and probably around the world, but I don't know. So basically, like in the UK, okay, and I think America, I think they're quite big as well. But essentially, a mastermind community is a group of people coming together to help each other solve problems, right? So we kind of say, if people go, what is it? I say, it's kind of like group mentoring. It's kind of like cohort coaching, kind of very similar to what you've just said, right? So we don't go through a particular kind of journey or anything. We're not, as a company, not really trying to achieve anything specific. Like, our aim is not to say we're going to take people in that don't understand New View and then spew them out as New View professionals. That's not our aim. Our aim is just to help people solve problems. So it's an open community. Anybody can join. It is a paid community, so it costs you to join. And we run two weekly calls, so you can turn up whenever you want, on a Wednesday at 6 or a Friday at 12. We also run like a book club, a philosophy call, and a quarterly event as well. But interestingly, and the reason why I mention it, not for it to be an advert, is because it's really similar to that kind of experiment that you're talking about. Ultimately, it's the benefit of having people at different stages in their own journey. No matter where you are in that journey, you still bring value to somebody else that may be further ahead of you in that journey or behind you in that journey. It's that cognitive diversity in a way. So we've seen this like beautiful emergent kind of development in something that we kind of knew would be good, but we didn't know it was going to be this good.
Right.
In that, getting a load of people in a call every week, and you know sometimes we have a call with like loads of people in, like the whole community turns up. At the moment we've got 30 members. We've been going about, I don't know, maybe 9 months. About 9 months, 9-10 months. So we've got like 30 members now. Sometimes you get a call with loads, like 15 members, and you're like, Jesus Christ, this is chaotic. And then sometimes you get it with like a handful of members. Mm-hmm. But mine and Colin's job, and we've got a couple of people who facilitate calls for us as well. But Sam and Elisa have done a really good job kind of helping us facilitate calls. All we're doing is facilitating conversations. You could, in a nutshell, say they're kind of unstructured learning teams. We don't have a desired outcome, but ultimately it's very similar. So sometimes you'll have a member will come in. We've got like a base model for our weekly calls. We have a topic that we might have decided we're going to talk about, or we might not, as a, we've got like a private LinkedIn group, so sometimes I'll put on there being like, I want to talk about this later. But then what we do have is an opportunity for any of our members to come in and say, right, I've had a problem today and I need some help. So we've got a topic, so we're going to talk about learning teams, for example, today, right? But James has just turned up in a call and said, I've just had this shit hit the proverbial at work and I need some help. We flip over into what we call kind of coaching mode. So we're only allowed to ask questions. So everybody in the community is only allowed to ask, in the call, is only allowed to ask questions of that person for about 5-10 minutes, depends how long it goes, just so they can understand more of the context. We need to understand the problem.
You're unpacking it.
Yeah. So I might turn up and say, my boss is a dick, right? Mm-hmm. And then you might go, explain to me why your boss is a dick, James. And then the next question would be like, why do you think he's like that? And you build the context to your point. And then we can flip into solution mode. So it's really interesting having those cohort conversations. And I think it's unbelievably underutilized, particularly in safety. And I think it's interesting to your point, the reason why I kind of explained that model as to why we kind of talk about that. It's interesting when we flip that over and compare it to training. And what you said there, in that we're running like a no training experiment, for example. I wonder, not sure I have the answer, but I wonder if it's like, it's not an or, it's more of an and. Like training has, there's an imparting of wisdom that we need to do sometimes. Like there's an imparting of knowledge that we need to do. And I do think training should exist and it does have a space. But I also do think there is a place for cohorts to emergent to have those emergent conversations and help each other solve problems. Because what you described to me sounds very similar to what we used to call apprenticeships, except we didn't have those cohorts. So I'd love to see modern day apprenticeships where you've got a relationship with your assessor, but ultimately you're also doing the job and learning from an on-site mentor, but then you're also having conversations with a cohort of people that are all on different points of their journey, and you're all helping it.
Yeah. So we call it learn, do, challenge.
Okay.
So you have to take on board a new concept. You have to apply that concept. And then you have to challenge that concept to understand how and why it worked or how or why it didn't work. But you need to do those three components.
Uh-huh.
But what we've tried to do is that we're doing within a framework.
Yeah.
So we've described an outcome. And we've basically said that for these outcomes, there's three elements. There's someone who's emergent, there's someone who is competent, there's someone who has mastery of skill across these elements. And people understand where they're at now. And by the way, it's not a test, it's not a study. It's we've used descriptors to demonstrate the types of function or the types of scenarios or context around those core competencies. And a person is able to think where they sit within that frame.
Yeah.
Okay, so rather than saying, you know, are you the most amazing facilitator? Well, where's the context of that? Okay, so we ask questions around, about how you would deal with someone in a disruptive group, or how, you know, get you to think about different components around that to break that down. But the objective here is to basically move people in a way where they not only gain that new knowledge through that process of exchanging conversation and also undertaking some form of activity, because these activities, they're not pre-built. These activities get created as a thread of an outcome.
Yeah.
So the challenge for us is we have to create something for the group, for them to see. And what we've also done is we've actually physically produced a journal. And that journal also contains those core principles, those core concepts. And we're allowing people through that process of a journal to create an actual framework of reflection. Because we take for granted that someone can reflect. I tell you, that's a big call, mate. That's a huge call.
And the power of it as well.
Yeah,
like, but I don't think anyone appreciates the power of stopping and having to think about what you just read or listened to or discussed.
Yeah. So part of that process is that we're getting the teams to self-reflect.
Mm.
Reflect with someone outside the cohort that they have a relationship with, and then do a group reflection.
Yeah.
And all through this process, what's happening, James, is that these skills are building for people.
Yeah.
Versus when I think about training, it's come in and be told. I think of it as an equivalent of water torture. Okay. So we're gonna pour water on you and hopefully something's gonna sink in. Okay. And if you don't get it right,
torture works, but yeah, I get the analogy.
Have you been on training courses where some bits of it have really been interesting and other bits of it, you know, you're willing to live?
I've probably delivered some of those training courses as well, Brent, if I'm honest.
Yeah, and that is because the training course is a blunt instrument.
Yes.
And doesn't take into account a person's prior understanding. And the problem because they're blunt, because a course has some learning intentions or some learning outcomes.
Yes.
Very seldom do we do any prior assessment of where that person sits within that.
Agreed. Yeah.
Yeah. So they're quite blunt, and the reason why some parts of the course found interesting is probably because those things related to your beliefs, and when the person spoke about things that didn't relate to your beliefs, you turned off.
Yeah. But ultimately, though, I mean, it's an interesting discussion, because in the UK, the HSE published a very, I think it was quite a while ago now, but they put out a paper that said that manual handling training does not achieve improved technique. And it does not show any evidence to reduce musculoskeletal disorders or anything like that. So basically, it doesn't achieve what we're trying to do via manual hand training, which is improve technique and reduce injuries, right? That's what we're trying to achieve. And there's no evidence in this research, just one paper, and I've only seemed to have found one so far, this one paper by the Health and Safety Executive, who in the UK are the enforcers of our management towards the risk of health and safety. And yet we're like still doing manual handling training. And interestingly, when I challenged an officer of that same health and safety executive, I said, right, look, you've published this paper, your science division have published this paper, right? That says manual handling training doesn't work. That's basically what it said. It said that we should, as employers, but it did caveat this point by saying that more research needs to be done. But it said ultimately employers should invest in strength and conditioning, fitness, health, well-being, and so on, right? So why are the enforcement agency not reacting to that? They are still requesting to see them in training. And when I kind of challenged that, they didn't really have a response. They basically said, if we turn up and you haven't done manual handling training, but you've just subsidized the gym, then we would enforce on you. So I was like, okay, that's not really my point. But what the interesting point is that doesn't seem to have sparked a further conversation to challenge the effectiveness of how we traditionally deliver training. Yeah. I do, however, yep, and this would be my kind of question to you, I do think that an organization does need to sometimes, not all the time, sometimes I think they do need to state, we're trying to achieve this learning outcome.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying don't train.
Yeah.
I think there's a different situation here that when I think about how we're trying to help people embed the new view of safety into everyday practice.
Okay. Yeah.
We're taking a bunch of competent professionals who have spent most of their life acting in a expert or a technical capacity of their work, and we're now asking them to be a facilitator and a change management person.
Yeah. See, I think this is interesting then, because I think this is where this slight misinterpretation that I've had of what you were saying is really interesting, because that's what I think has happened in this new view safety as well, in that my interpretation of yours was this kind of sweeping generalization that training doesn't work and we should have this more emergent kind of way of learning, which it has a value, but also so does training. But to your point, the scope was when we're talking about new view safety or safety differently, e.g. we're talking to a load of competent professionals, e.g. they've already had loads of training. So I think it's really interesting.
Well, they've got to a point somewhere. And
yeah,
and I suppose what we're saying in safety, and it doesn't matter whether it's safety, whether it's quality, operational, it doesn't really matter what it is. These people are having to move between these constant two worlds of being a world of being an expert and a world of being a facilitator. And they're two different mental models.
Yeah.
But the point is, we're having to move between them.
Well, isn't that the nature of work, though? With work being a social and technical system, that's inevitable. We have to, what you've just said, facilitator is social and expertise is technical, in my opinion, if we were going to loosely tie those two together. Loosely.
I mean, yeah.
It's technical and social, and ultimately, if we are operating in a socio-technical system, we are always going to have to flip between the two.
Yeah, but the thing is, that's I suppose what we keep coming back to: how do you build that skill to do that?
Mm.
Because one thing is really comfortable, and one thing is uncomfortable.
Yeah,
one thing is really structured. One thing is really organic.
Yeah.
Okay. That doesn't sit well with people. Does it make sense?
And yeah, no, loads of sense. I mean, it makes loads of sense.
And
also, I think, Brent, the issue is that we have loads of technical people in the workspace, and we train the shit out of people. We build technical experts left, right, and centre, right? We do it all the time. We don't – when have you ever seen anyone go – that's our social expert over there, or that's our social team. We got, here's our technical teams. Here's our social experts, or here's our social team. You don't see it. We don't address the social issues within the workplace at all, in my opinion. Or traditionally we don't, at least.
No,
and I think that's what Nuvel is trying to do, is bring sociology, psychology, or those kind of types of philosophies and practices into the workplace.
Thank you, listeners, for being part of this podcast. We would love to hear your learnings or other topics you would like us to explore about learning teams. Go to www.podcastlearnings.com and give us your feedback. Become part of the community of practice with learning teams. Go to www.learningteamscommunity.com. Support the authors of The Practice of Learning Teams. Purchase the book from Amazon.com or go to www.learningteamsbook.com for an inside look and other free book resources from the authors.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.